Retrocast, where we go back in time to Ring of Honor's past and reminisce about the noteworthy, the landmark, the unique, or the bizarre shows in the history of that wrestling promotion. We're going to cover what was going on in ROH at the time, review the show, give our thoughts on the matches then and now, and have a whole bunch of good discussion in the process. But for that, I cannot do it alone. So let me introduce to you my fellow time travelers for this episode of the show. First up, we have my co-host from Podcast of Honor, and yes, the actual webmaster for PWPonderings.com, but he is also, like Jerome Cusan, an all-around person and a man with a million internet projects going on at the same time. Chris GST. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay, Ari. I'm kind of tired as of this recording, but I'm good. I'm ready to talk some Ring of Honor, especially this show, because it was one of the first ones that really caught my attention in terms of what Ring of Honor could do, and their, especially when faced with issues.
Well, I appreciate Chris GST. All the way on the West Coast, it is a brisk midday, 12 p.m. or so over there, but he had a rough weekend, busy weekend, so thanks for joining. And also back again is my fellow Brooklynite and currently the poll master, not the webmaster, the poll master on the We Love Pro Wrestling Facebook group. And you can find that group on Facebook. He is also an all-around person and an ROH and wrestling enthusiast, Chris McKeo. McKeo, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm just recovering from the UFC that Ari and I watched last night, which was an outstanding show.
Yes, this is recording this about a day or so after the great UFC 166, an amazing night of fights, and we're still in the recovery process. We are also very, very much recovering from a late night, so we're going to make the best of it. All right, with the introductions out of the way, let's get in the telephone booth. Let's dial up another blast from the past. Let's be excellent to each other. And GST indicated this is going to be one of his favorite shows. In our last episode, we covered the debut of the Age of the Fall faction, which was our friend Matt Waters, one of his first and favorite shows. This time around, we head back to May 22nd, 2004 for another show with an important stable formation, so important that it took on the name of the show, Generation Next. And the show is historically important to Ring of Honor for a number of reasons, which we'll get into as we roll on here. First of all, a unique fact about the show is that it took place in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, outside the Philadelphia National Guard Armory, not inside. That's right. I said outside. It's one of the rare, if only, Ring of Honor shows that take place outside. I guess, does anybody else remember if there was another show that took place outside? Was it maybe Glory of Honor 5 Night 1? I remember that kind of had AstroTurf on the floor, but I don't think it was outside. I think it was like an indoor stadium or field.
Yeah, I think it was inside. It was like an indoor sports complex kind of thing.
Yeah, so this might have been one of, if not the only, Ring of Honor shows to take place outdoors. And the reason that happened, I mean, the show was initially scheduled to take place inside the Philadelphia National Guard Armory, but during this time, there was troop mobilization during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and that meant that the interior of the building was being used by the United States Armed Forces. And this put ROH in a little bit of a bind, but they cobbled together a last-minute solution in holding the show outside the building. They set up a huge tent, and they put up their lighting up inside the tent and the chairs, and they had themselves a wrestling show. So GST, and then I'll turn to Mikio, your thoughts about sort of how this show kind of came together at the time. All of us were following Ring of Honor at this time, so we sort of had an understanding that this was a unique situation. So GST, what does it say that they were able to solve a difficult problem here by holding the show outside?
Yeah, I think it spoke to Gabe's ability to not just book on the fly, but realize that there are production issues. You know, obviously taping outside, not the easiest thing in the world. and especially given the budget that Ring of Honor had at the time. So when I, what I remember slightly was hearing about it and not quite understanding. I thought the person was joking when they said, no, the show is taking place outside. And this was, of course, back in the day, you know, before smartphones and Twitter. And I was just getting emails. And I'm not, to be honest, I don't even really understand how I got the emails, but I got emails and some texting. And I just thought, you know what? That's pretty awesome. Yeah, they didn't turn away the fans. They didn't say, hey, you know what? We can't do it today. And then, of course, and Ari, I'm sure you're going to get into this a little bit later, the booking of the show had to change because of this. So I'd say kudos to Ring of Honor for that time. I mean, because this had to be just a huge issue, getting to the building and then being told, you know what, guys? Can't go inside. So good for them.
Yeah, definitely requires a lot of, problem-solving abilities. I mean, it's not easy to just set an impromptu show and, give the space for the fans, the barricades, the lighting. Everything was set up really well. And, I think part of the reason why this show, obviously besides the formation of the Generation X faction and maybe the upper card of the show, the big reason this show is remembered is because of sort of the unique atmosphere in which it was held. Mikio, what do you remember hearing about the show at the time? Or you can give us your general thoughts about ROH around this time in 2004, as far as, your thoughts of it, where you were, your fandom at this point.
You had really just gotten me into it at the tail end of 03, so I was really hot to pay attention to what was on here. I remember when I read a review of the show online that it was that it took place outside, I was like, oh, this is going to come off like crap on DVD. And when I went back and watched it, before in the run up for this podcast, one of the things that I really kind of noticed when I was watching it was that, RH at that time had a production issue. They had like the white hot camera all the time. And for this show, which they did, like we said, on the fly, the camera was never hot. It was never, never got that white burn from anything that you would watch. The setup of the ring and the setup of the ringside area was great. You really couldn't tell. The only time you could really tell that it wasn't inside of a traditional venue was, I guess, during the Second City Saints Prophecy match when they go like outside of the tent and really onto the lawn, I guess, of the armory there. And that was really the only time you could tell. I think, they did a great job. They really kind of, they were given some lemons by the situation, but they really, like ROH did a lot at that point. And they took those lemons and made, some of the best tasting lemonade that you'd ever had. So, at that point, a lot of the guys, and we'll talk about this later, I'm sure, but the guys who were, who formed Generation Next, they had been on a couple of shows, mostly Do or Die type stuff. And, you'd seen like glimpses of them and you were like, wow, these guys are pretty good. I mean, except for maybe Alex Shelley, who I guess we'd both kind of talked about a lot at that point, because we'd seen some of his Border City stuff. And we were both kind of, I think, I know I was, and I know I'm pretty sure you were too. We were both kind of enamored of his work, to kind of see these guys be given an opportunity to really kind of, seize the ring. I think both of us were really psyched to see it, to watch it, and to jump off with it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, now I want some lemonade, so thanks for that. And I agree. I think that, Austin Aries, I believe, got his first shot in the morning at the Do or Die show on WrestleMania weekend. And I didn't go to see that. I saw the evening card. To go from that, then a couple months later, be featured in an up-and-coming stable, obviously. I think that says a lot about what supposed to be thought about him and his potential at the time. And Aries did quickly rise up. And Shelley,
I think Roger Strong debuted on that Do or Die too also.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Yeah. And Strong's debut was there too. So again, you're talking about guys who, and Shelley was there before that. He was on the main card, but he was doing some stuff with Jimmy Jacobs and some pure wrestling rules matches here and there. They were dipping their toe in the water with him. They weren't really giving him the big shot because their priorities were elsewhere at the time, and understandable, and obviously circumstances changed. that and allowed all these guys to really get the opportunity to make a name for themselves, really starting with this show. And then the other note about this, as far as what makes it historically important and you know, the overall context of what happens on the show, to go right into that, is that it took place a few months after the Rob Feinstein scandal. And now, we don't have to go over the details here because, you know, they've already been hashed out many times over. But, you know, obviously it had severe consequences for ROH at this time. And it was even thought that it meant the possible end of the promotion, you know, that it might have to shut down because of it. For sure, some big names in the business that were scheduled to make appearances, like Rowdy Roddy Piper and Bobby Heenan, I think, on that WrestleMania weekend show for At Our Best. I think Piper was scheduled, sure, but canceled his booking, and Heenan canceled his booking, and that was part of the fallout. Now, Heenan did eventually work for with Ring of Honor, but Piper never did. TNA also pulled out its contract of talent at the time that were allowed to work for Ring of Honor, and that included the likes of AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels and Jerry Lynn, and some wrestlers who had begun affiliations with TNA but were long-term TNA talent, like CM Punk. They had to make a decision whether or not they were going to try to get their opportunities in with TNA or whether they would side with Ring of Honor and choose to stay with them. And because of this, the Daniels and Prophecy, Christopher Daniels and Prophecy versus CM Punk and Second City Saints feud that was happening at this time pretty much ended before it could get going. And ROH had to strip AJ Styles of what was the new Pure Division that was happening, the Pure Division title. They just had a huge tournament for it. And it was, you know, essentially scrubbing the division for several months before they could recover from it. Now, obviously, Daniels and Styles, even Lynn, they would show up many times over throughout the history of Ring of Honor, but at the time, nobody knew if they were coming back or not. So this brings us into a crisis point, because Ring of Honor needed new talent, and they needed a way to get the upper card to mean something before any damage was done to roster depth. So, GST, any disappointment over the fact that guys like Styles and Daniels weren't able to be used at this time?
I would say disappointment from the sense of, I understood, and even back then, where TNA was coming from, and I had those same fears that, you know, you heard about people pulling out of Ring of Honor, including even Samoa Joe said he had some reservations now about working for them, and I'm glad things kind of smoothed over, but
right.
I wouldn't say disappointed as a fan, and I know that sounds weird, but it was because I had such an interest in the upcoming wrestlers anyway, and I felt that even with guys getting pulled out like AJ Styles and Jerry Lynn, that they would still be able to have some of the best wrestling. And of course, that was probably just my bias also. You know, I was one of those robots that just was like, you know what, they'll do what they can with what they have, because that's what they've always done.
Right.
It was, though, you could see the, I don't want to say it was a dip in interest, because obviously I couldn't gauge that, but while I was running the Live Journal, we got a lot of comments from people who were obviously very weirded out about the controversy and were saying, like, you know what, I don't know if I'm going to buy Ring of Honor for a little bit. And right. Obviously now, what, we're here 11 years later, so I guess we're okay. But yeah, at right. the time, but I think we also knew in some degree that TNA was going to make an ultimatum, you know, because they were on, I think they were still doing those weekly pay-per-views, but they were still obviously on a right. larger platform. Yeah, so they were still so the larger.
If it wasn't this, it would have been like some other point where they said, you know, make a decision which way you go.
Right, because I think around 2004, they were realizing they were losing money, and I think that was right around the time that there were reports that someone was going to buy them out or, you know, fund them, and they were going to have to be a little bit more, I guess, corporate-like. Mm-hmm. So I kind of figured it was going to happen at some point.
Fair enough. All right, so let's get into the show and talk about the decision to change the Generation Next tournament into an angle to form one of the greatest factions ever to be known in Ring of Honor. Let's set the stage. Samoa Joe's in the second year of his record-setting Ring of Honor world title run. It's about 15 months in and is building up a really strong amount of momentum and buzz for doing so, although he would be about a year away from the real big breaking point where he fought Kenta Kobashi. So he's starting to really make a name for himself. Homicide has just turned heel off the Ring of Honor Reborn shows, where he snapped after losing his cool during a previous Ring of Honor World title match against Joe. And that ended with a close two count that Homicide thought was a three count. Julius Smokes turned the light off in the building, and Side throws a fireball right into Joe's eyes. Gabe Sapolsky put it bluntly, "The demon has risen," as one of his famous infamous
It wasn't
quotes.
Gabe Sapolsky, it was Chris Lovey.
Oh, it's Chris Lovey. I'm sorry. Chris Lovey. Yes.
They're two totally different people.
Sure, Chris, sure. Also, the prop seats at Kansas City Saints are in a war, even without Christopher Daniels, and they have traded the tag team titles of each other in the Briscoes at Round Robin Challenge 3. Finally, there's an eight-man tournament that was going to be held to determine who the new young, upcoming top athletes were in the water. And that was going to be decided in part. They're going to hold the matches and then have a fan vote. And if you know your Ring of Honor history, you know how well fan votes go. So maybe enough said about that for now. So again, Samoa Joe is your world champion. Second to City States are your tag team champions. And believe it or not, I've actually been able to pull up the top five at the time. Homicide, BJ Whitmer, Alex Shelley, Brian Danielson, John Walters. That's your top five rankings for this point in history. Make of that what you will. So we start with a prophecy promo with Allison Danger wanting the prophecy to win the tag titles for Christopher Daniels, who is, as we said, indisposed at this time. Matt cuts a promo beginning with the phrase, "When we look through the time of times." Yeah. He pulls it together after that, though, and he still has issues with BJ Whitmer this time, but they work well together. And Matt says, "We're going to win tonight, or it's the death of the prophecy," which shocked both Whitmer and Allison Danger. But I remember Matt promising to walk out of them many times, so it's like, whatever. Then we have the Good Times, Great Memories backstage interview segment in neon font, and your host is Colt Cabana in what appears to be a dungeon, probably just backstage. Special guest is Trent Acid wearing a Fabby's Just Super Size shirt. I don't think talking about fat people or McDonald's. Yeah. So talk turns the Carnage crew, the crap in a bag angle, an angle I know all of us here would love to forget about, but it refuses to be lived down even now in 2013. Trent Acid loves what happens, and he says that the Carnage crew deserves it. Lo and behold, they show up and they demand Acid spill the beans on the info he knows. Acid says that the people responsible are here, but before they can beat him out and get the info out of him, Masada stops them from hitting Acid. I wonder why that would be, guys. Anyway, they demand, beats the hell out of me. And they demand Acid bring the people responsible to the ring. So Chris, any thoughts about these two backstage segments, starting with Chris, GST?
No, I thought it was fun. You know, they were doing the Colt Cabana thing. And I think he was I would say he was already over at that time, but it was just something fun. It kind of brought something different to the beginning of the show rather than just straight to the ring, you know, and ring entrance and whatever. So I thought it was kind of fun. The other one, I mean, it is what it is. It just kind of furthered the storyline, and they had to do it. So whatever.
Yeah, there was a lot of prophecy backstage segments, and then the camera guy would like say, "Are you guys for your promo?" And then everyone would like look at the camera and get into like promo mode. Not really. I know a lot of people weren't really the biggest fans about that kind of style of setting up promos, but it was what it was.
Well, because it was kind of weird, because it kind of took you out, because it's like
it's kind of jarring.
You were going to edit it. And then you said, "Okay, guys, we're ready for your promo. Now go." You would have edited that off. So why would it be there? And of course, you knew that this was because they wanted to show you that footage. So it's kind of like, okay, I get it. They did it every time, though. So to me, just kind of became numb to it.
Exactly. It became like commonplace to see it. So you're just like, all right. It's like somebody's going to say, "Are you ready for your promo yet?"
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could imagine somebody would say that, but yeah, you're right. It would probably be edited off if you were really doing it. I guess they might have wanted to do it like a guerrilla style. Anyway, Mikio, any thoughts about these two promo segments?
What's it called? The Math Whitmer one to start it was, you know, whatever. It was funny. I'm sitting there watching the stuff about the crap in the bag, and I tried to block that out of my head for so many years. And the only thing that popped up into my head, when I was watching it again, was I didn't know Randy Orton did any time in Ring of Honor.
Oh,
wow!
Jeez.
Sorry, I couldn't resist it.
That's okay.
It's right up there with Twinkies. That's all I'm gonna
say.
Taking
the place of Matt Waters there for bad jokes.
That's kind of like an homage to a friend of ours who works at another website who sets up all his jokes really well in advance. So we'll leave his name out of this. But
sure.
Ari, you know who I'm talking about.
No, I have no idea. But
yes,
I have an idea.
You know exactly who I'm talking about.
Do
I have to say Dark City Book Club to you? Come on. How long you thought he'd been thinking about that one before he cracked that one on us?
Perhaps. All right. Let's get to the ring with what appears to be a tag team scramble, and it was supposed to be Don and Marcos, the Ring Crew Express, up against the Christopher Street Connection with Ariel before she was in Shimmer as the Portuguese Princess Ariel. So I kind of forgot that she was actually part of that group for a little bit in early Ring of Honor versus Special K. So. Yeah, as mentioned, Chris Lovey is announcing the show, and Mark Melty is on color commentary and is useless for the most part throughout much of this first half and in the second half too. I didn't miss him so much. And of course, Russell said Chris Lovey is really keeps Pulski under a pseudonym. Shh. So of course you know when you realize that no one is using your real name. So they go through the original Generation X tournament as it was supposed to be on commentary. It was supposed to be Jack Evans versus Roderick Strong, Alex Shelley versus Izzy, Hydro versus Austin Aries, and Jimmy Jacobs versus Nigel McGuinness. And the fans were supposed to vote on these matches, determine who impressed them the most. But before things can really get going in the show or this tournament, out comes Austin Aries, Alex Shelley, Jack Evans, and Roderick Strong, and they come out and they destroy the Christopher Street Connection. There's no match. Alex Shelley cuts a promo scrubbing the scramble match. The tournament, the fan voting, declares the beginning of Generation X as a stable. He says, "We are the best athletes in this company now." He dubs the group Generation Next. As he mentions that, one of my favorite lines, that he has talent on loan from God. Brilliant. They throw away the ballots. Don and Marcos come out. They try to make a stand, and they're not going to take it. Well, they do, and there's the Generation X beatdown. Our first real match is actually Generation X of a group of Evans, Strong, and Aries up against Izzy, who looks like Mike Quackenbush Jr. in this match, Angel Dust with a neck brace, and Dixie. Not Dixie Carter. Generation X is described on commentary as brash, cocky young superstars in the making. Strong gets, I thought he got over big time in this match by showing off his chops and backbreakers even early on in his Ring of Honor run. Special K actually gets a little bit of offense here. They give him a little bit of trouble, but it's a quick match and triple finishers for Generation X. A spinal shock by Strong, a 450 by Aries, a 630 by Evans, and that gets the win. The crowd approves of Generation X. And this was a good start to the stable, especially because of the cool multiple finisher sequence at the end. Some destruction of people is always fun. So, Mikio, thoughts on the opening segment and first match of Generation X in their stable history?
I thought Alex Shelley's promo was phenomenal. I thought that he was the guy at that time who was just, in my estimation, and I think in a lot of people's estimations too, so he was really so hot at that point. Like, when he would cut a promo, it would be on the money. When he would wrestle a match, it would be on the money. And I think most of us just figured that the sky was really going to be the limit, you know, for where he was going to go. And like you said, that when he used that line, you know, talent unloading from God, I mean, it was just like, you just like, oh my God, did he really just say that? And it was just, it was such a great, you know, little touch to the comment. And then to launch into the match, though, the way that it was like, it was one of those like amazing kind of like, like showcase type situations to kind of really get over how excellent all those guys really were, and then to have them all showcase, you know, or do the three, you know, showcase the three different finishers, and then do the triple pin. It was just it just really kind of put home the point of everything that Shelley had said in the commentary or in the promo, it really made the if you want to call it the hijacking of the show, you know, it made it mean something bigger. The idea that to do this, to shift the focus on with the company because of the losses of the guys, like we talked about before, it really did. It made you stop thinking about who wasn't there, but it really started to make you think about who was there. And I think to start the show off like that and to hit it so hot and to hit it so hard, really, it almost like turned a new page for ROH at that point, in my estimation.
Yeah, I think it put the focus on not like, oh, what was supposed to happen, but hey, look what's happening now.
About what we're missing. Think about what we do have, because what we do have is still really freaking good.
Yeah, and I think right off the bat, you know, and even with the next match too, you get a good semblance of their personalities and what they're about. As a group and individual, I'd have to say. So, GST, thoughts on this opening segment and the first match?
I think it really showcased, as Mikio said, that all three guys in this first match, you know, they all brought something different. Roderick Strong, clearly with the chops and the backbreakers, he was the muscle of the group. He was the Arn Anderson. And I don't think he was – pretty sure he wasn't you know, training the same way that he trains now. So he was also a little bit bigger back then. So it really put that over. And then Austin Aries was the technician. The few matches he'd already had in Ring of Honor showcased that. And then Jack Evans, of course, the probably one of the best high flyers of that time period. And probably, you know, still today, he would still be in that category as well. So I think it also, you kind of knew after watching that match, like something else was going to happen in the show, because it was, I'm not saying it was short, but it kind of was. And you're like, yeah, they're saving themselves for something else.
Well, right away, right after that, you have three guys in their match. And then Alex Shelley is obviously the leader, or at least it becomes clear that he's taking a leadership position. He's the one talking the most.
He was the de facto leader, because I think he was also the best known, right? I mean, we kind of knew who Austin Aries was. Yeah. We knew Jack and Strong, but still.
Yeah, but Shelley had really... He'd made the name a little bit in ROH at that point. The other guys really were still kind of like unknowns.
Sure. So people knew who he was, and so he would have a little bit of a legitimacy or a credibility. And so he runs his mouth, and Hydro steps up. Now, what they were doing at this time is actually Special K been around really almost since the beginning, and there were people would come and go. And I think at this time they were trying to intimate that like Hydro was maybe getting serious, or he had the potential to be, a serious guy. And Hydro obviously would become later known as Jay Lethal. So, and I believe he was wrestling in Jersey All Pro at the time as Jay Lethal. So it was interesting that, you know, people kind of knew who he was, knew that he had the potential at that point, but. Obviously stuck in a, or put in a, I don't know, not stuck is the wrong word, but he was put into a lower card stable. And so this is where he had a chance to step up, or was beginning to step up. Shelley actually, offers him a card of honor as they set up their match, but Hydro refuses it because Special K was not shaking hands at the time. And this was a short but competitive bout. I think the highlight for me was Shelley's technical abilities. He did some sort of like catch bridge into a border city stretch, then Lethal reversed it to a Buddha lock. I really like that sequence. Shell shock into the border city stretch, gets the tap. It should be noted that Shelley was getting both pro and negative chance in this direction. So the crowd kind of interestingly split on a heel faction, but it's Ring of Honor fans. So even then, you know, they would definitely kind of boo the faces, but they wouldn't necessarily boo the heels unless they, you know, there was a reason for it. They wouldn't mind them if they were really good workers. Shelley offers Hydro a spot in Generation X, but he declines to the crowd's boos. So that also surprised me. And Evans' reaction, Jack Evans, is great here, saying, "You're just going to beat down more," and going all, you know, 8 Mile on him.
He was the king of Parkland, Ari. King of Parkland. Come on.
That's right. From Parkland, Washington. Yes, yes. So, or was it the Prince of Parkland? That
Prince. Maybe it was Prince.
Yeah, I think it was Prince, yeah.
Yeah.
But he was so poor he couldn't afford wrestling gear.
Yeah, but he had a nice, you know, the do-rag, which, you know, everyone was always, like, waiting for when it would come off and stuff like that. So, any thoughts on this match, guys?
No, I mean, I think the technical ability of both was on showcase, because you could see that. That's probably why, because at this time, obviously, Ring of Honor fans were, they were known that we loved the in-ring product slightly more than, you know, outlandish storylines and whatever. And I still think they were cheering for Shelley just because they knew he was a good wrestler. And that's what they were cheering. They weren't cheering his character. They were cheering that, you know, this is some, you know, badass wrestling. And Hydro, you know, Jay Lethal, he was doing the chain wrestling too, so it worked out. Of course, you know, he had to have Shelley go over, but I think this was where you could start saying, okay, Hydro, you know, you can be something. And I think it was Hydro, Izzy, and Dixie that would later splinter away from Special K and kind of go, you know what, we want to be serious wrestlers. We really want to hone this craft. And, well, one of them did anyway. So, I don't know. I guess it just was what it was. It was meant to be a showcase match, but I think they were planting the seeds that Jay Lethal was going to showcase what he could do.
Yeah, I think, you know, on the same note, it's like watching Shelley kind of do his thing, the transitions from hold to hold, from move to move with him were just so smooth, and it only happens that way because you have another guy in the ring who's just as good. And, you know, Lethal or you know, Hydro held his own pretty well with all that. And you know, you're right. It did totally plant a seed for that. This guy is more than just, you know, one of these, you know, these quote unquote rave kids from this group. And it was really great just to watch these two guys, you know, so early in their career kind of put this, you know, put on, even though it was short, put on a really good demonstration of what they really could do given the opportunity.
I'll make a really corny comic book geeky joke and say, "Hail Hydro."
No.
Moving on.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So back to crap in a bag. Carnage Crew versus Trent Acid and Danny Daniels. And before this match could really get going, and it's going to be like a refrain, I think, for this show, Masada attacks the Carnage Crew from behind. So one of their own crew essentially turns on them. Gabe loudly and definitively exclaims that it was Danny Daniels who crapped in their bed. So history! How he would know? I don't know.
He had the inside scoop, Ari.
Oh,
I believe it was the inside poop, Chris.
There you go.
Yes. Thanks, guys. Appreciate that. So there's a huge brawl around ringside. Justin Credible is there, too, and he helps out Logan DeVito on their side. Gabe, at some point, tried to connect what Daniels did to Luke as a result of their refereeing days in ECW. It's a bit of a stretch. I thought Nolte was awful here on commentary, and Sapolsky, I'm sorry, Jimmy Bauer, has to do a yeoman's job working around him and getting over his angles. I think this was such a great angle, but, you know.
When was Nolte ever good on commentary, Ari? I was watching this, and it just brought back some bad memories. I was like, oh, this guy, man. I mean, yeah. It's not that he was bad, but it was clear that he was just there, and he never brought any insight that made any sense. All he did was ask questions. He was kind of like the guy on NXT who always asked William Regal really dumb questions. That was Mark Nolte.
Yeah. Not a fan at all. He would try to do a lot of connections to like history and stuff like that, but I never bought into it much. So Trent tries a springboard, but Justin Credible gets a super kick. Well, sort of like a thrust kick. It was kind of cool. Shades of like Shawn Michaels and Shelton Benjamin before that happened. And Trent has a Yakuza kicks, HC log, Luke, sorry, while, or log, you know, shit log, sure. While hip thrusting to get the three. Not terrible, but not good either. Anybody agree, disagree?
Nothing memorable. It was funny to go back and watch and see like Masada like then and like to think about him now.
Sure.
But otherwise, and it's like, you know, it, you know, Trent Eston had a couple shots, you know, he had that, what was it, on the Testing the Limit show where he had that really decent main event match. But, right. You know, it's just, he was always a guy who kind of, you thought might have something, but just never really did. And I hate speaking ill of the departed, but yeah, that was pretty much it.
Yeah, this was one of those things where you could tell, though, the booking style for Gabe was you'd have a kind of a brawl in the early part of the show to get the crowd into it, but then later on in the show there'd be like a really serious, you know, brawl, hardcore match, whatever you want to call it. So this was just kind of the uprising. This was just to get the fans like, hey, we're getting, you know, something other than a technical wrestling match. Because, and I think that showed the intelligence of Gabe, knowing that the crowd, you can't just have technical wrestling matches one after another. You have to give the crowd something different.
Yeah.
So this, and this was it. Not saying it was good, but it wasn't, you know, it had a point and there was a reason to have it where it was on the card.
I think for me, this was one more match where like there was a chaotic environment to it. So it sort of added in to a show that was filled with that. So then we go to what was supposed to be Jimmy Rave versus John Walters. And this was, again, supposed to be a last chance for Jimmy Rave and Ring of Honor, as he was on a massive losing streak, working as a face at this time. The fans chanted the goodbye song to him as the match began, and that's just cruel. No wonder he joined up with the Embassy when he had the chance, right?
Yeah.
So Generation Next comes out to interrupt the proceedings, making a habit of it. Alex Shelley gets on the mic, says, "We are taking your spots, chopping the rungs from underneath you." It's a 4-on-2 brawl. Roderick Strong, at this point, he does this just crazy cross-arm pile driver, and that is not a move you see out of him these days, and just a youch moment. Again, no match. Chris, what did you think of all these matches being scrubbed at the time? I mean, it was definitely an unorthodox tactic here, and I doubt it would be well-received now.
The infrequency of it, when it happens, makes that impact. So the fact that this, it doesn't happen on every show, that's why it worked, you know. And then later on, WB used it for what? For the Nexus and Shield. It works. You just can't use it all the time. So back then in Ring of Honor, it was like, oh, you know, crap, we've never seen this before. So I think it worked.
Yeah, I agree with you, Chris. It's because they hadn't done any kind of like that jerky booking before this. It was kind of like, this really is a show in chaos and everything's upside down and you don't know what's going to happen next. And that really made the show feel so different from almost every show you'd seen before it at that point, that you were kind of like, whoa, is it, something's really happening here.
Right. I think the only other time really where it kind of felt like a card was up in the air was Unscripted back in 2002. And
yeah, I was just about to bring that up and say, but well, even that was different. Ahead. No, I was just going to bring that up and say, even that was different because you knew the card had to be changed around. Whereas this was like guys taking over the show and you were supposed to feel like, wow, they're really hijacking this.
Yeah. The only other shows that really had that totally like kind of the wall screwed up unpredictability where like there was that show out on Long Island with the snowstorm.
Yeah, that's Unscripted.
Yeah, it really didn't happen that frequently. So it, like when they did it the way that they did it on this event, for this event, it, you know, taking the change of venue, then doing this, it really kind of made it feel like everything was being shaken up from the foundation of the building all the way to the top rungs, that everything was kind of being adjusted.
Okay.
And it was kind of funny because they just came off that whole like the whole Reborn series where they were really kind of changing the, you know, changing everything around, almost like you know, a comic like reboot kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens right after that, and it does a great job with it.
So the only official Generation Next match to go on as scheduled is next, and that's the Nigel McGuinness-Jimmy Jacobs match. And I think it's funny to go back and see this match now, given recent angle developments in 2013. Now Nigel McGuinness is the authority figure in Ring of Honor, and Jimmy Jacobs was a member of Scum, and you know, was knocked out thanks to the end of Scum angle and you know, now he's got a second chance. So very interesting to see how far back their history goes, although it's not necessarily a major history point, but interesting nonetheless. So wrestling match generally is kind of quick. Also, there's some cool stuff here by Jimmy Jacobs with like a rope walk chop and some arm work by Nigel, and he shows some of, you know, he's also in the beginning of this his ROH run here, so he hasn't quite adapted the strong style. He's doing more his European technique based offense. Something really cool that happens during this match is that the sun is setting, and I thought that was a really cool visual and added something to the entire show, not just this match.
Kind of like the show is going to get serious now, right?
Ah, yes. Yes. You know, the change in
business is about to pick up.
Yes. If you say so. I think maybe that should happen for all sunsets now. In the future, we'll say that. Anyway, there's a couple of close two counts, and basically Nolte again is off here. He says something about reversing polarity off a drop to a hold. What does that even mean?
Yes, I remember that line.
I don't know.
It, when I heard it, because you know we just recently rewatched this for this review, and in my brain I was like, what does that mean?
Like, I don't get it. Anyway, Nigel gets that arm submission for the win. I don't even think it had a name. I just remember in people's reviews, I think it was Garud and Ziegler's reviews, they would call it that arm submission. I thought this was too short to really mean much, and both were still very early in their ROH runs and before their character evolutions, which made what they did in the ring mean that much more. But an interesting time, you know, at a time, you know, looking at it, you could definitely see the beginnings of who they were, what they would become in ring of honor. So, Mikio, thoughts on the match?
I thought that Jimmy Jacobs doing his miniature version of Bruiser Brody thing was somewhat entertaining.
I know you weren't a fan of it at the time, though. So.
Yeah, I know. Going back and looking at it now, it's kind of entertaining. It is kind of, you know, I think the playing off it, because maybe because I was I've always been a Brody mark, that I took it too seriously at the time. And you think about it, most of the stuff in ROH at the time was pretty serious, and I looked at that kind of like at the time as a slap in the face.
Sure.
You know, going back and watching it now, you know, it was cool to see how Jacobs looked then as opposed to like with the show that we did on the first retrocast. Just the kind of evolution of who he was between, you know, between this show and, you know, which was what, 2004, and then the show we did recently. So that was kind of neat to see. Like you mentioned, the one thing that stuck out with me with Nigel was that he had totally not picked up any of that, the strong style stuff. He wasn't like, you know, Larry had obsessed Nigel McGuinness at that point. And it was interesting to kind of see him do a lot of different things. The Tower of London spot that he wound up doing about three quarters of the way through the match was awesome. I mean, he did like the inverted suplex to put Jimmy Jacobs like onto the top rope, and then they did the Tower of London, but only after Nigel had already done his headstand in the corner. And I thought that was just so, so cool just to see those kind of things like string themselves together. And otherwise, you know, it was good, and the crowd was into it, and you could tell that they liked, you know, both the guys who were in the match, and it wasn't anything spectacular, like you said, but at the same time, it was, you know, it was a decent match.
And GST, agree, disagree?
Oh, completely agree. I mean, Nigel doing the catch-as-catch-can style was different, and you didn't see that type of wrestling in America very often. You know, of course, early years of Ring of Honor, you had Doug Williams doing it, now you had Nigel doing it. And I think it worked.
Like the pure rules division stuff that I think got into.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one day we're going to have to do a podcast where we really talk about the parallels between Jimmy Jacobs doing that Bruiser Brody kind of spoof, you know, for lack of a better term, but how his career actually parallels Brody's in very similar ways. So we're going to have to get into that at some point. But this match was kind of, you know, like you said, it was not, you know, it was short. You know, not like 3 minutes short, but, you know, it was just there, and I think the fans enjoyed it.
Cool. And that takes us to intermission and backstage on some steps. Homicide and J-Train intimidate Sugar Sean Price, or SSP, or S to the S to the.
Don't lie, Ari. You miss him. You miss Sean Price. That guy was gold.
Oh, that guy was terrible. He was horrible.
Wasn't he backstage at a show recently? Like just to say hi.
Wasn't he like Samoa Joe's buddy or something?
From the area or something.
I don't know. He always reminded me of.
He was so awful. My God, it's hurting me just thinking about it.
Come on now. You reminded me a little bit of. Do you remember? You know Sal Masekela?
Now you're insulting Sal Masekela. Okay.
I knew that would get on Mikio's nerves a little bit. Anyway,
that's an insult.
Yes, a voice, not necessarily quality voice, but whatever.
I think Mikio just likes seeing Becky Bayless do the backstage stuff instead of Sean Price. So,
well, it depends on which kind of backstage stuff you're talking about. Becky Bayless doing there, Chris.
Oh, wow. Anyway, afterwards, we get the Ring of Honor World Tag Team. I'm trying to get away from that as quickly as possible. The World Tag Team.
Wait a minute. That references back to kind of Trent Acid's quote from the Good Times, Great Memories before, right? Yeah, at the beginning of the show. I know about rats, but I'm not a rat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see? And Becky Bayless? I don't want to say anything more, but you get what I'm saying.
Anyway, no disqualification. The Second City Saints. CM Punk and Colt Cabana up against the Prophecy, Dan Mapp and BJ Whitmer with Allison Danger at ringside. This was after the tag team titles had changed three times on one show. That was Round Robin Challenge 3. The Prophecy beat Second City Saints on that night for the titles. Then Steamboat forced them to return to ringside. The Briscoes beat the Prophecy, and then Second City Saints beat the Briscoes to regain the titles. So make of that what you will. Punk is in basketball shirts and blonde hair. What a difference. I mean, and Punk has definitely evolved in look over the years, but it is amazing the difference in look between then and now. The crowd supports the Prophecy more than Second City Saints, which I think is testament to how much some people really, really, you know, hated CM Punk at the time and how he got under their skin. And, you know, the guy just yelling at CM Punk, like, and Punk daring at him to do something. Just, I just remember those going to shows and just like seeing that scene and being like, what is going on? How can someone like just viscerally react to Punk that way? But hey, he gets the reactions like that, doesn't he?
Yep.
And, anyway, there's not too much of note early on in this match, but something of note is that they do the Second City Saints do this tag team move, which is a reverse Boston Crab and Camel Clutch. And it's actually, if you take away the Camel Clutch, an early version of the Billy Goat's Curse move that Cabana would come to use as a submission finisher. So just a little tidbit I thought I'd throw in, something I noticed. A lot of good tag team moves, some combinations. The fight goes outside. There's some guardrail moves that are quite impressive visually. Look like it killed everybody.
Say Whitmer and Moff probably still feel some of those shots. I mean, when I was watching, I was like, God, years later, you're still feeling the pain from some of that.
Yeah, when you look at Ring of Honor history, if you want to list guys who took some of the worst beatings in ROH matches, you know, BJ Whitmer, I mean, he has to be right at the top of that list. This guy took, it seemed like he was the guy who always took the huge beatdown.
Right. And Moff for his size. I mean, think about Moff. You know, everyone's always impressed with Colt Cabana's moonsault, which I was too, obviously. But Dan Moff doing the tope was like, dude, do you know how big you are? You don't need to be doing this on guys smaller than you. But he did. And, I mean, he's still wrestling today. So, you know, kudos to him.
Whitmer tosses Cabana into the crowd, and they fight into the 10-site area. They fight to the field, as we mentioned before. Only the spotlights above the ring are tracking them, so I thought that was cool and a different visual, which helps makes just kind of an otherwise average match to that point stand out, and it also gives the fans who are at 10-side, you know, or general admission standing up, just something special that's happening, like, right in their face. There's some cool chair shots by Math onto Punk's back. They toss each other around for some chairs. Math throws a chair onto Cabana, who was raising a chair. So meanwhile, Punk gets the Shining Wizard Whitmer in the ring for a close two count. And then something of note is Cabana just like blatantly being a heel during this match, using a low blow behind the ref's back, and it's just so odd to see him healing it up.
Yep.
You know, but that's what he was in Ring of Honor during this time. He was sort of under CM Punk's thrall, and he was still doing the comedy gimmick, but also kind of still doing the bad guy stuff. And Punk does some kind of spine buster backbreaker, which I don't think I've ever seen from him since. So, again, some interesting stuff in this one, stuff you really wouldn't see out of the guys, like, you know, basically 2013. Our finish is that all four men are on the top turnbuckle fighting it out. Cabana goes through on one side. Ma flops through like a table that's set up on the other. It's a short fall. It didn't look so great, but it leaves CM Punk and BJ Whitmer on the top rope, and CM Punk gets the Pepsi plunge on Whitmer to retain. This was, I think, the first match for me to break like 3 stars. I gave it 3 for the double teams, the brawl in the crowd, and the finish. And you know, good match. You know, this turned into something really cool by the midpoint, because again, it was, you know, the environment and the effort these guys put in. So GST, thoughts on all of that?
This was kind of what I was alluding to earlier, where, you know, we had Trent Acid and the new and improved Carnage crew against the regular Carnage crew. So that was just kind of like the regular brawl. This was the serious, you know, stuff where the fans were really getting into it. And you could tell as they're building through the match, you know, these guys really knew the story they wanted to tell, and the fans were into it. You know, Cabana and Punk, probably the best, well, you know, at least in the top five of the best heels in Ring of Honor at that time. You know, they really knew what they were doing. You had CM Punk, who was just visceral and just hated everyone. And then Cabana, like you said, he was doing the comedy thing, but he would always tell Punk, you know what, hey, I'll do whatever it takes to win. So when he did the low blows or the poke in the eyes, right, he was just trying to, you know, help out Punk. Because you kind of had that feeling that they were the odd couple, whereas when they
that's
lost...
That's exactly what I was going to go for.
Yeah.
I think I have that written in my notes from when I was watching the show.
You had that feeling that if they lost, CM Punk would probably go to the back and beat up Colt Cabana. You know, because he's like, you know, why did we lose? It's all your fault.
Yeah.
They had that weird relationship. But yeah, no, this match I thought was good. And I agree with you. It's probably the first one that, if there are star ratings, this broke the 3-star thing. One thing to note that I also thought that throughout the match, you could kind of tell that, I don't know if they meant to, maybe I'm just reading too much into it. You could, because there were times when Moff could have saved Whitmer, and he didn't. And I kind of felt they purposely did that, so that it was kind of like Moff trying to say to Whitmer, you know what, you either win this, you know, you fight on your own like I am, or this is the end of the prophecy, which, you know, turned out that way anyway. So
right.
Anyway, that might just be me reading too much into it.
No, I think that's a really cool thing I didn't pick up on, so kudos to you for that, for sure. And Mikio, thoughts on Second City Saints during this time, and your thoughts on the match?
The combination of having such a serious guy like Punk with a guy who has that, you know, that comedic streak in him, I think it worked. It really did work so well. It's like whenever they would be on, it's just like they kind of just chewed up the scenery. You just kind of really wanted to just keep watching to see what they would do next. And it's funny because it goes, once again, going back to the good times, great memories from the beginning of the show. When the Carnage crew showed up, I mean, you look at it, what was Cabana's reaction to it? He hid under a table. So it's like, you know, when anything serious or anything crazy is about to go down, he's already established himself in that little promo piece from the beginning as kind of being like, you know, afraid of serious circumstance. And then it's like, you know, then you see him in a match like this and it's like, hey, wait a minute, this is the guy who was hiding under the table before. What the hell? But then, you know, like you said, Ari, with him when he healed it up and delivered that, you know, that low blow, it was like, it's like, wait a minute, that's Cole Cabana. He's the funny guy. He's not supposed to do stuff like that. But like you said, I think he was afraid at the end of the day that if they didn't win, you know, Punk would slap the taste out of his mouth.
It has been years since he's done some heel stuff here and there. I think he was supposed to be a heel in the WRP, and he's a heel during the Juggalo things. He does the Officer Colt Cabana stuff. But as far as stuff like on Ring of Honor and then in PWG and Chikara, I mean, he's been a good guy for the better part of the last 7-8 years. So
yeah, I mean, he's done some
serious. It was definitely kind of like
You think about like the feud with Homicide and all that. He's done some real serious stuff too, but it always had, you know, it was always Colt Cabana. It was like, yeah, he's Colt Cabana. And it, but that with that, you know, seeing that, it was like, wait a minute, that didn't, that really, wow, that's kind of surprising. You know, it's funny you mentioned Punk wearing the basketball shorts. That was one of the things that I kind of noticed.
Bring
that, you
the
know,
basketball like, shorts back.
No, it was like he had them on. Alex Shelley had them on earlier in the show. Alex Shelley did wrestle his match in regular tights later on, but he was wearing basketball shorts too. And then Homicide wrestles in the main event with basketball shorts. So I was wondering, maybe like Dick's Sporting Goods closest to the venue, maybe they were having a 3-for-1 sale.
No, this is obviously Ring of Basketball Shorts.
But I mean, just to, you know, like you kind of mentioned, you kind of alluded to like how much, you know, how much he's evolved in the time since then. Yeah. It's like, you know, all those guys, you know, it's like you look at the, just look at the look. And Chris mentioned before about Roderick Strong. You look at the guys who are still around or still, you know, are still on the, you know, out there on the circuit. And you see how they've evolved since then. And it's really kind of, that was one of the coolest things about watching, you know, a show that is 9 years old. Right. Is that you've seen what these guys have become. And it's really kind of interesting to see that and kind of take it all in.
Colt Cabana still kind of looks the same.
Yeah, he hasn't changed at all. it's almost like he hasn't even aged for the most part.
Well, I think he looked younger at the video for sure. I think I've could tell. I could tell for sure. And he's a little bit less. He's actually a little bit less built than he is now. But whatever. Anyway, let's keep on going. And Gary, not Becky Bayliss. Sorry, Chris.
That's okay.
Gary Michael Capetta, who is the other backstage interviewer on this show. He's with Special K, and they're down in the dumps. Aww. What do you think will make them happier? I think I know. Then Sugar Sean Price is there again with the prophecy. Danger answers the door and closes it on him. Good. Good for her. And our next match after that, the Briscoes versus the Outcast Killers with Prince Nana, and I actually have no clue who the other guy was accompanying them. Was it Josh Daniels? Does anybody know?
I couldn't make it out. I couldn't figure it out either.
Yeah, no, neither could I. I had no idea who it was. But man, you know, you gotta admit, you missed the Outcast Killers. Don't
Oman Tortuga and
Diablo Santiago.
Diablo Santiago. I mean, how can you forget a name like that? I just did. Think you know what's gonna happen here with Generation X running in? No, they're not out to stop the match from happening yet. There is a note that says no commentary due to technical issues or technical difficulties. Maybe that's a good thing because we avoid Mark Dolphy for a bit. Outcasts were Nana's men. They were early goons of the embassy, and they would get demolished, and then Nana would excoriate them for doing a bad job, and they promised to do better the next time. And, well, they're going to have to promise to do better the next time because they lose. It's a short match, though. It's longer than I thought it would have been looking at, you know, on paper and where these two teams were in the pecking order. But it's mostly the Briscoes on offense, and they get a combination J-Driller and Cutthroat Driver. They do it individually, but it lands at the same time, and they get simultaneous pins on the Outcast Killers. Now, Generation X comes out to ringside as the Briscoes make their exit. The Briscoes get back in the ring, and Shelley has the microphone again. We already took two spots tonight. He says we want two more. The Briscoes, well, Jay, he responds with some vulgarity. There's a shock. Questioning who the bleep they are. Shelley retorts with the quote, end quote, "You are dumb redneck. I don't know how good you guys are at math, but this is 4 and you are 2. So Walters and Reeve come out to make it 4-on-4. And if you're listening at home and are good at math and logic, you can deduce what happens next. Chris, are you good at math and logic? Do you know what happens next?
Well, yeah. I'm horrible at math.
Fantastic. So before we get there, any thoughts on anything that I just went over from anyone here in our roundtable?
Nope. No thoughts. It was just a match.
Just a match. Mr.
Yeah, Hill? It was getting you from point A to point B.
Sure. Fair enough.
I wrote down one thing. I thought the Outcast Killers outfits were a little too busy for my taste, but that's neither here nor there.
Mm-hmm. They would not be out of place at the New York Comic Con doing cosplay.
No, not at all.
Or something from the Transformers. Anyway, Generation Next in full. If you haven't gotten enough of them during this show, now you're going to get even more. Eight-man tag. Shelley, Aries, Evans, and Strong versus Walters, Raven, the Briscoes. So even 3 years before the Age of the Fall show, show up and they debut at Man Up. Gabe Sapolsky's booking of a new faction is to have them appear multiple times. So this match went 40 minutes.
And beat up the Briscoes, apparently.
And beat up the Briscoes. Hey, excellent. Hey, you know, GST, you just solved that second part of the equation. I was not observing that, but you got it. Now, this went 40 minutes, but it was a match that went quite quickly. It was filled with constant activity and something intriguing to watch. I mean, in the beginning, our process to me, I thought, guys, was filled with lots of interesting chain sequences and the promises of first time combinations. I mean, it really felt like a struggle between the two sides. And then by the end of the match, it's just like an all-out war. There's just so much. Roger Strong again wows the crowd with the chops. Even Sapolsky has a comment on it. Shelley's shoulder work on Walters early on was smart. I thought it looked great. It played into the finish. Jay Briscoe's knee was also worked on throughout the match. And by the mid, he's not able to run the ropes. And Sapolsky's right on top of that, telling us about it. And provides a lot of doubt about him not even being able to get on the J-pillar. Now, I think a lot of people look upon this match and think very favorably on it, and I really enjoyed it myself, but I forgot and was reminded watching it again about the two botches near the end. The first one was Walters nearly losing Austin Aries in the top rope dominator type move, and that could have been disastrous, and in a different timeline, Aries could have been like a vegetable right now. And then the Briscoes kind of saved things up a little bit, but Shelley missed a save and the ref just stops, and it's noticeable enough for the fans, the crowd, to, you know, they pick up on it and they boo a little bit. So for me, it brings it down a little bit in retrospect, but maybe you guys can get past that and enjoy the match for whatever it brings to it. I mean, I think I did it back then, but this time I found it more difficult. But the finish comes with just a crazy amount of moves, and I think a lot of people can forget because of that. Evans bumps like a madman. There's Border City stretch by Shelley on Walters as Aries blocks Rave and puts him in the ring, the Rings of Saturn for the tap. The crowd chants matches of the year, and while it's really good, I don't know, especially 2004, there were probably a few more matches that were better than this one. So even in 2004, Noir fans are overestimating matches. But I would put it at, you know, 4-star range, 3 3¾. 4 stars, depending on how much you take off for the botches and the falls 3. GST, your thoughts on the match, on the pairings, and the action in the ring at the time. Do you think this was the match that you remember in hindsight?
No, I think I'm kind of with you, where looking back on it and remembering, because the same thought passed through my mind, like I thought I remember this match being maybe slightly better, and I mean, look at us, we're saying it's a 3 3/4-star or 4-star match, and we're almost talking about it like it was horrible.
I'm not saying it's horrible at all, but there's, you know, there's a couple things here and there that you can pick up on now,
right? And maybe, you know, maybe we probably picked up on it back then too, but maybe you kind of forgave it because you understood this was the culmination of these four guys really getting over. And of course, the Briscoes were already established. Walters and Rave, you know, still kind of, I would say Walters was probably more established than Rave at this point in Ring of Honor. And I think that it matched up well against guys like Shelley and Aries, you know, because they really could do that technical work. Whereas the brawling of the Briscoes against, you know, the hard hitting stuff from Strong and the high flying from Evans made sense also in terms of match style. The in-ring stuff, I thought it was good, you know, because it made you notice the four different styles that all Generation Next members had. And then you kind of knew going forward, okay, this is where they're going to go, you know, because you weren't, once the match was over, you kind of knew Strong and Evans would be the team and that Aries and Shelley would be the pillars of the group. So, I don't know, I enjoyed it. And looking back, I was like, okay, I was probably more forgiving back then. But still, I mean, those two little mishaps, not enough to dampen it for me.
Yeah, there was also the Jack Evans totally, when he does his backflip off the top rope to the outside, he totally missed.
Yeah, he does that a lot. I mean, and maybe that's the guys on the ground's fault too, because if
not there even come close to making it look good.
Right, but maybe that's the guys on the ground's fault too, because like maybe he overestimates it and goes too high.
No, he undershot him. He totally undershot him.
Oh well, you know that's Evans.
If it's overshooting, then it's the guys on the floor. If it's undershooting, it's the guy who's doing the move. But you know, I agree with you guys that the other two kind of spots where you know with like issue that you could have issue with, you know, does it change the way I feel about the match? No, not significantly. You know, but I do agree with both of you guys that I had remembered it being better than it was, but that's not to say it wasn't good.
Oh, right. I still got into it. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, it's like it was a really like, you know, we talked about showcasing before, but that match was such a great showcase for really everybody involved.
Right. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, you got the Generation X faction forming in the beginning of the show, and then you got a 40-minute match, and you're not sick and tired of it. I mean,
to see more.
Yeah, you knew this was just the beginning, but you were definitely, your appetite was wet for more, and you know, again, and then obviously the other thing being there's a lot of short matches in the first half of the show to lead into this really long match. So everything, I think it all kind of fit together pretty well.
The last 5 minutes, though, were just so strong. It's like you can't.
Oh, yeah.
Just, no matter what you want to nitpick, you just can't nitpick those last 5 minutes of that match.
Right, which is why I think the crowd should have a match of the year. Because those
I also tend to think that those last 5 minutes of that match really came back to kind of to bite them in the ass with the next match, is that I felt like the crowd was really kind of I thought they were kind of exhausted going into the title match, which comes up next.
Right. Well, actually, no, the Steamboat CM Punk confrontation comes
up. Oh, that's right. Okay, excuse me. But the next match was the Joe Homicide match.
You're right about that. Yes. The other thing is, I want to agree with GST. Walters looked pretty damn good here, and they made a good point of him working with Rave. And I wonder that, you know, maybe a Rave Walters team at this point would have been interesting. You know, they had a lot of good chemistry, and they didn't even get the team up when they were both, you know, briefly on the embassy together at the same time.
Yeah, I always kind of wondered about that because they seemed like they had chemistry. You know, and then later on in the future Generation X, they would face them, and then. Well, Matt Stryker won. I mean, whichever Matt Stryker you want to call him, they team up with Matt Stryker, and they had something. And I don't know. Maybe Ring of Honor just didn't decide. Oh, they're not going to be a good tag team. They're better off as singles guys. So
Matt Stryker unibrow or Matt Stryker ECW commentator version.
Unibrow.
Yeah,
unibrow. Yes. Okay. So Ricky Steamboat and CM Punk have a quote unquote confrontation, and they couldn't call it a match. It really wasn't a match, but they couldn't do a match, I think, because of I guess at the time Steamboat had some sort of legal issues with his wife about the rights to his name. I don't know. It's I've always been kind of confused about the order of all that, but suffice to say, this is a continuation of Punk's interactions with Steamboat that had begun going all the way back to the beginning of the year. He was like special guest referee at Our Best for the Pure title match with AJ Styles, and they had some friction there. So here's a verbal confrontation, and Punk goes over Steamboat's history, and he promises to make history at Steamboat's expense. It turns physical pretty quickly after Punk offers to be a man of honor and shake his hand, but you know, obviously when Ricky goes for it, it's a cheap shot. Steamboat gets in his trademark, some great chops. It goes back and forth a while before Colt Cabana comes in. And again, Cabana, he blindsides Steamboat. It's amazing to see him as a heel and like sort of relish in attacking Ricky Steamboat. Punk level Steamboat with the top rope elbow with the bell, a la Macho Man Randy Savage, and what he did to him way back when to set up their the Savage Steamboat WrestleMania 3 match. And since this isn't TNA, we're okay with ROH using WWE history in the promotion, right, guys?
Sure.
Just
maybe.
Maybe. I don't know. anyway, Moth and Whitmer come out to stop anything further. Punk and Cabana head out. Damage is done. At the time, I thought this was like really cool because it was
It
kind of,
was, yeah.
yeah, you know, just that Steamboat would interact with Punk. And again, because he wouldn't get into an official match, this was probably one of the things that they did that was as close to an official match as they could, sort of like what they did with Samoa Joe and Mick Foley in early 2005. And I just loved the hell out of this segment. So, you know, something I'll always remember. Mikio, I know you're a huge fan of that WrestleMania 3 match. I know you're a huge fan of Punk. So, what did you think about this sort of tete-a-tete at the time, and what did you think about it while watching it back now?
At the time, I probably feel pretty close to the same as I do then as I do now. It's like you kind of really got to see the it factor with Punk. You know, when he came out, you know, with his AFI theme music, and then he jawed with the fans. It's like you really could see that that he had something different than the other guys. Than I would say than almost every other guy. In the promotion at the time, that there was just something about him that was the reason why they would want to put him in a situation with a name like that. It's like they did it with him and Raven. They did it with him and now with Steamboat. I think he was maybe one of the only guys who could really assert himself with I guess you'd say with the legends of the business. And
And he
to
had
see.
the segment with Punk too later on as well, you know. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, so it's like, you know, you kind of you think about it in terms like that is like whenever they did bring in one of those kind of like, you know, those legendary type
I
figures,
meant, did I say Foley? I meant Foley, right?
you meant Foley, right?
Yeah, I meant Foley.
Yeah, so I mean, he had like you think about it when ROH brought in any of those like big name guys who are legendary, you know, from their exploits, it was always Punk that got matched up with them. So it's almost like, you know, it's almost like Gabe is like showing his hand that what he believed about Punk before, you know, maybe anybody else did. That, you know, he knew that he was the guy who could handle, you know, the largeness of that stage being out there with a guy like Steamboat, or the guy like Foley, or a guy like Raven. And I really think he brought it home with that with the promo that he cut, and then like you said, having Cabana kind of come out and heal it up again. It was an interesting way to look at things, but I've forgotten how much I really did love Punk's Ring of Honor entrance. I really miss that.
Yeah.
If there's anything to be said about Gabe is that he has an eye for talent, and I think it was obvious here. You know, he pretty much picked. He said, you know, Samoa Joe's, you know, our guy. CM Punk is our guy, and then you know everyone in Generation Next. I mean, look at where they are now. You know, they, you know, maybe some of them could be in a better position than they are, but still, they were all four very talented wrestlers. So
Yeah.
I think this was just, you know, another showcase of that. And then of course, Steamboat being a Ring of Honor was special. I think, you know, at the time. Yeah, I never got to see Steamboat Flair obviously live, but I had watched those matches by then, so I knew the significance of having Steamboat interact with him. So it was a good time.
Yep.
Yeah, smart crowd. Obviously, I think a lot of us had seen those matches, if not live, then, you know, through DVD releases or VHS releases. So, you know, I think a lot of people in the crowd really did appreciate Steamboat at the time, and I think like the Punk interactions worked really well. And then when he came back and did the thing with Mick Foley about Honor versus Encore, Hardcore, I think that worked a little bit less well. But you know. You have two guys like that, you gotta see what, you know, if he can work something.
Well,
But
'cause it kind of felt like a rehash of what he did with ECW with Foley, you know, Foley and the anti-hardcore stuff and, you know, in ECW. It was kind of,
that's true, that's
yeah, it
true.
kind of felt like that. But I mean, you understood what they were doing, and of course, Ring of Honor being on a smaller platform, you know, whatever.
Whatever indeed. Whatever is the word. So our main event is Ring of Honor's world title on the line with Samoa Joe once again up against Homicide. And I just full credit to Sapolsky on commentary. What a job he does. Getting over the feud and the talking points about the match and the psychology in the match as it happens. This is just such a brutal brawl, but in a very good way. Some sickening moments, though. It might turn off some people, but I really, really enjoyed this title match at the time, and I was surprisingly, I forgot about it a lot, and then watching it again really reminded me to how good these guys were against each other. When Homicide makes it a brawl, you know, it really kind of there was a danger to this match that really made me stand up and take notice. So I won't go over the action in the ring in depth, but I did think that there's some amazing headbutts by Joe. I thought that the stuff they did outside in the ring where Homicide misses on the Topicohelo and crashes through the table that was set up like sort of horizontally on the barricade, I thought that was crazy, and full credit to him for doing it. And the match is basically Network versus the injured Network. It's the first time Joe bleeds in the title defense. There's a ghetto fork that is used by Homicide to make him bleed.
It was an extra sharp ghetto fork, if you listen to the commentary, Ari.
That's right. Sapolsky said he saw him sharpen it on some bricks, which, man,
that really sharpens it. You scrape a fork along some bricks, it'll do it. It'll get the job done.
It'll carve you up in a second, man.
There you go.
There's a tease of a Muscle Buster that won the Do or Die One match that they had a year ago. A Muscle Buster from the top rope, and Homicide gets out of that.
Can you imagine actually taking that?
Oy.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Well, and the fact that there was the tent, I think the tent made it difficult to do some of the top rope moves, especially for big guys. You know, I think they were really sort of almost touching the top of it. It was a little bit tough for them. So anyway, there's another tease of the Reborn, like close call with Todd Sinclair, who's got a buzz cut and a goatee. I kid you not, times have changed. He does an excellent job as his hand goes down on the three, but it's a 2.9 because the guy, he gets his hands out at the last second. And so that looks great. And it obviously drives Homicide even crazier. Joe pours on the offense on the attacking Homicide's neck. And the finish is kind of different. He, instead of doing, you know, the Island Driver or the Muscle Buster or even the choke, he gets a Brain Buster after overwhelming Homicide with a bunch of different string of offense. The Brain Buster is enough for three. It's a different finish, like I said, but it makes sense because of the headshots that Homicide took, especially in the final minutes. To me, I think the Joe Homicide feud, one of the more underlooked aspects of 2004 at the time, it really kind of went hand in hand with a lot of the stuff, you know, like that was going on with the Joe Punk feud, the hour draws they did, and Homicide was sort of right there as well, doing his stuff and getting noticed. So let's go to GST for thoughts on this match. Did the finish work for you because it was different, or do you think that maybe something else should have happened?
No, the finish completely worked for me because, you know, growing up on the wrestling that I did, you know, the early 90s, you know, nowadays when wrestling fans, when they watch wrestling, they expect to see the finish be because of the finisher moves. But on the wrestling I think all three of us grew up on, you didn't see Bret Hart use the sharpshooter in every match to finish it. You know, maybe you saw him use a pile driver every once in a while, or the La Magistral. You know, we saw different moves finish it just because of the caliber of the wrestlers involved in the match. And this one worked because, as you said, Homicide, and throughout the entire match, I mean, Samoa Joe's suplexes, you know, whether it be a Tiger or the T-Bones, they've always looked brutal. And you knew it really broke down the opponent's head, neck area. So when you saw him win with a Brainbuster, it made sense. You were like, yeah, this
surprised you.
Yeah, it didn't surprise you. So I think that, like you said, it kind of gets underrated just because throughout the year, I mean, 2004, there was no shortage of great matches. You know, we had, speaking of Homicide, him against Brian Danielson at Reborn. And then, of course, you had Jay Briscoe, the cage match with Joe. And then, of course, Joe and Punk, the entire trilogy. And then at the very end of 2004, you had Austin Aries versus Samoa Joe. So there was a lot of things going on in 2004 that had our attention. But if had this been focused on a little bit more, it's right up there. Probably in the top, not this match itself, but the feud, probably in the top five of things going on. So this match worked for me. And then, of course, yeah, Homicide and Joe, I would probably never get sick of watching them. But you're right, the brutality that it brings. And I think that my one issue with it, and it's not even an issue, but it's that after these types of matches, you kind of typecast Homicide as that brawler because you know he can... he can wrestle, but when you see him in matches like this and main events, that's what you want to see, you know? So you really wouldn't want to see him bring out the technical skill that he can do. You know, we've seen it, you know, in JPW, we saw a little bit of it in TNA, not really, but you know, a little bit. And I know that's it's a small thing, but after seeing him in a main event like this, that's pretty much all you want. So
ghetto fork, Chris. Ghetto fork.
Yep. You know, listen, the one thing that my big takeaway from this match is that the chemistry that Joe and Homicide had in the ring was just so sweet. They meshed so well together in putting on a great show, and it's like every move looked convincing. You know, from the punches and the kicks to to everything. Everything looked convincing. And it's a credit to both guys and how good they really are. And like you guys just said, easily top five of that year as far as their in ring action with each other together. So it's like, going back and watching, it's such a hard hitting match. You know, Samoa Joe at that point was like the beast. I mean, he couldn't do wrong in any ROH fan's mind at that point. All of his matches at that point were just awesome. And, Homicide had flipped the switch and turned it into the psycho thing. And like Gabe yells later, the demon's loose. And it's like, he did that so well. I mean, that was just like what he was so, so good at. But it was just, I felt, maybe because the match, not the confrontation that happened in between, but because of the match that had happened before being so, so long and so epic kind of thing, as far as like being a transitional match for the direction of the company, maybe this match really does get lost in the shuffle because of that.
How long was this match? Did either of you time it? I mean, it felt...
No.
It was not long. It was like 20 minutes, maybe? 22 yeah. minutes?
Yeah, so maybe had the 40-minute match had not just occurred, it would have... Right. Yeah.
Yeah, or if this... Or even according if you just reverse... To... If you'd reverse the order of the matches.
Yeah, something like that. Because that, that does make a difference, right? You see a 40-minute...
With the crowd, yeah. I mean, if you put the crowd through a 40-minute match and then expect them to be crazed for the next, two segments... It's just not going to happen. I mean, a crowd that's at a show for, 3 hours is going to lose momentum at some point. And you don't want it to be at the end of the show. You want it to be maybe like at the end of the first half leading into the second half so you can, they can recharge the batteries at intermission. But,
But you have to put the world title match at the end, You kind of have to.
That's one thing. And, the match that kind of led to the 8-man, you wouldn't want to have that, near the top of the card because it just didn't fit. So it's tough. It was a tough situation, but as far as delivering, I mean, Homicide and Joe definitely delivered, but you could tell that the crowd was a little bit tired during that match.
All right. Well, one for once, that is not my dog barking. I just want to point out.
No, that's my dog. He's fighting that's in Luke. The driveway with his playmate. So.
Okay, that's cool. People have here heard my dogs barking for so long that it's I don't take offense when that happens to me either. So I'm actually shocked my dogs have been so quiet. It's been kind of strange. Two, for media.com, went to JD Dunn's review of the show. It's 20. The match is 1957 is when he timed in. So 20-minute match. As far as the reaction from the crowd, you're right. The crowd was a little bit down by the end. But because of the 40-minute match. But, I think if I'm going to remember the show, I'm going to remember it for all the Generation X stuff, for the Punk Steamboat stuff, and for the Samoa Joe Homicide stuff. So I'm not sure it knocks my perception of the match as a whole overall down, but, I can see that point. So let's just quickly go over the aftermath, because that's important also. We get a promo again by the Prophecy, and they're not in a good mood, obviously. And Matt says, what do you think he says? One more shot to try to win the tag team titles, or they're done. And then, walks out. And then back in the ring, we go to Homicide, who is cutting a promo on the crowd. And I quote, you all make me fucking disgusting. Okay. He heals on the crowd, but they continue to applaud him. And that was sort of the gimmick there. That he would act like a heel and, there's my dog. Oh, there you go. And they just applaud whenever he's, whenever he does some sort of crazy thing. I do not need your fucking chance. More applause. He tears up ringside. Sapolsky goes mental on commentary, selling homicides and saying, he goes, the demon has risen. And then in something which has become a bit of infamous Sapolsky humor, he claims that he's going after the pillars that hold up the tent. Evacuate. And that's how the show ends, which, you know, you don't see homicide going after the pillars, but, you know, due credit to Sapolsky for trying. Okay, so that's the end of the show. Let's do some final thoughts and sort of thoughts on Generation Next from, you know, their impact from this point on. So GST.
Well, I would say I would recommend everyone to go get the show, but I think it's out of print. So the second best thing is
way out of print.
Second best thing is to get the, I think it's called The Rise of Generation Next. It's
right,
a
I was
going to
mention that.
Yeah, so go of your way, capture that. You know, it's some good stuff. And obviously all four guys in Generation Next, they had such a huge impact in the history of Ring of Honor. This show, yeah, you know, like I said, I would recommend seeing it. And if you can, I'm not saying you should do it by some illegal means, but it is worth watching and checking out. And I don't know, overall, it's just one of those shows where it's, like we all said, 2004 had a lot of stuff going on, so maybe sometimes, you know, it could get lost in the shuffle, but I think Generation Next is a show that should stand out, especially in the history of Ring of Honor. So, yeah, that'd be my vote for it.
Mikio, final thoughts on the show.
I agree with Chris. It's definitely a show that if you're a long term ROH fan, you definitely have it in your collection. If you're just getting into ROH, it's something that you should, you know, go and try to get your hands on, whether through compilation project like you guys mentioned, or even just looking for it on eBay.
I've seen people selling it on eBay.
There's a ton of old ROH stuff on eBay at this point. You know, there's only a couple of like shows from over the years that have become like really difficult to find on eBay, but this is one I think you probably have a good shot at getting your hands on. I would advocate that people go out of their way to really, if they could, to get their hands on this one, to watch it just to see the whole picture, not just, you know, what a compilation project is going to show you, but the whole thing. Other thing, you know, a couple other small things that I loved and back from this era and I miss. I loved it when Gabe used to do the time to pay the bills section, you know, segment. Because it was just,
it was,
you know,
that time like, again.
Yeah, it was like, exactly. You just kind of like waited throughout the whole show for how long would it take before Gabe would, you know, do the time to pay the bills thing. So that was cool. The one thing that did like totally irk me from this show, not enough to make me change my opinion of it, if I heard them mention the top five ratings again, I think I was going to really hurt somebody.
Well, they had to get that over. I mean,
I understand they're trying to get over. They showed a graphic at the beginning of the show. That should have been enough. They didn't have to mention it every time that someone who was from the top, you know, the top five. Well, if he gets pinned in this match, he might lose his spot in the top five. It's like, okay, I get the picture. If you lose, it hurts your momentum.
It was better than
you don't
the
have to
contenders
tell me that.
Trophy.
Oh God! Better don't even start. The, don't even start with that stuff.
What was Cornette's deal? The pick six.
Oh.
Yeah, instead of five, six. Oh,
but you know, otherwise, it's a great show. It's definitely something that should be seen by anybody who's a fan of ROH. And they, like you said, the guys who were part of Gen Next. I mean, they've all gone on to such good things. You know, in varying stages, of course. I mean, Aries, you know, with his title run, and then you know the work he's done in TNA, and you know Shelley's success overseas. I want him to be back in the United States so bad. I want to be able to see him kind of on a weekly basis because he's just so good. And he's only gotten better. So, you know, Jack Evans, you know, he is what he is. He's I hate to use the term spot monkey, but he's a bit of a spot monkey. And
it works in Mexico, though. I mean, you know, for where he is now in
his
career.
Place there.
He's found his place, and you know it's like he's let's be honest, Jack Evans is kind of an acquired taste. You either really love it or you're just kind of like I was always kind of So it really didn't bother me. But the guy who really, it's almost like a different guy. It's like Roderick Strong. It's amazing to see how he's changed physically in the last 9 years, that, you know, how he's taken things so seriously and gotten in such great shape. And it's like, he really
is a vegetarian,
like,
now also, right? Or he yeah.
Like, he's, like, you realize at this point, it's almost like he's like the godfather of Ring of Honor. I mean, it's like, besides, you know, Homicide has been gone for long stretches, but Roderick Strong has been, like, you know, the big mainstay in ROH now,
Strong,
like, forever.
Strong and Briscoe, and that's it. Strong, yeah. Briscoe and Jacobs, and, you know.
Yeah, but Jacobs was gone for a long period of time, too. So it's like, you look at it, as far as being consistently on an ROH card, you look at guys like you said, the Briscoes and Roderick Strong have been there, like, forever. And they're still just as fresh, though, in a lot of ways today as they were then.
Oh, yeah. So I mean, right now, the thing that holds my attention really is, you know, Homicide with the Outlaw Inc., with Kingston. The Briscoe thing is kind of cool. And, of course, I think we've talked about this before, Ari. Roderick Strong, it's like, what are they doing with him? There's a lot more that he could do, and I he's just kind
of
there.
I believe he is Mr. Ring of Honor.
Yeah.
Maybe
at this point, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing for him. I mean, they need to get him back into some sort of title contention, because he's that good.
I think they'll keep him running with the Adam Cole, rivalry for a little bit. But you guys are right; he does need a little bit more of a refined, specific character, motivation, and direction. So let's hope that they can do that. But That's in the present, and back in the past, obviously, Generation X was just starting out, and obviously the next 2 years, they were either on the, you know, whether they were heel faction or a face faction, these guys were set up for major success in Ring of Honor, and there was really everything kind of comes together for a peak in 2005 and 2006 for Generation X and Ring of Honor. So with that in mind, as GST said, you can catch most of Generation X's history in the Rise of Generation X compilation DVD. The Second City Saints match was the Prophecies on the CM Punk Second City Saint compilation DVD. And I have to imagine that the Joe Homicide match is either on the Joe or Homicide compilation, maybe both. I didn't look that up, but I'm sure if you go to Parlors.com and check out their compilation sections, you'll find it. So just in case that show is out of print, but the matches that are important to Ring of Honor history are definitely available for people who want to watch them. And that brings us to the end of another great ROH retrocast. Let's do some plugs. First of all, Chris Micchio, what are you working on? If you have anything to plug, just let the people know.
The We Love Pro Wrestling group on Facebook. We're going through the entrance music theme tournament right now, and that's going pretty well. We're into the second round on that. We've been pretty active with the Wrestlers of the Day stuff, and we cover all the pay-per-views and have chats about the pay-per-views going on when they go on. So if you want to join that group, feel free. We're going to be letting people in once a week from here on out, because our group is growing by leaps and bounds. And that's pretty much it.
Okay, and check out, I guess just go to facebook.com and check out.
Yeah, just look up We Love Pro Wrestling and try to join the group. We'll pretty much take anybody, but once you act like an idiot, you'll find yourself on the way out the door.
And that is serious. That is legit. And for me, go to twitter.com at Ari Berenstein, A-R-I-B-E-R. And STEIN, if you want my Twitterings on ROH and other wrestling stuff. And check me out on Podcast of Honor at pwponderings.com with Chris GST. And GST, why don't you pay the bills? It might be time for you to pay the bills. If you have any plugs, the floor is yours.
Yeah, it might be time to pay the bills. So we want to thank everyone listening to the show. Of course, this is hosted on pwponderings.com podcast network. So if you're checking us out on Stitchers or iTunes, please leave a 4 or 5 star review. We'd really appreciate that. Of course, you probably get enough of my ramblings on another podcast here at PWP. So I'm just going to end with, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/CGSTong. That's CGSTONG. And of course, I'll be reviewing some more Ring of Honor for Total Wrestling Magazine out of the UK. You can check them out at twmag.co.uk.
Told you, the man does like a million things on that. All right, guys.
He's the man of many places.
That's right. So for Chris GST, for Chris Micchio, for myself, for my dogs, for Chris's dog, we'll see you next time on the Retrocast when we go back in time for the Ring of Honor show. Take care.